What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Locked On Vikings. I am your host, your pal, and the kid you copied off in math class. My name is Luke Braun. You can follow me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can follow the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. And we finally have the news we've been waiting for to go over. Rick Dennison has finally been announced as the official offensive line coach, as well as some other handshake deals that were in place got actually inked and solidified. Drew Petzing will be the wide receivers coach. Marwan Maloof will be the special teams coordinator. And that just about rounds out the Vikings coaching staff. So we can now, after this episode, turn our full attention to free agency and then later the draft. So I talked a little bit about Rick Dennison in the episode right after Gary Kubiak was hired. If you want to go scroll back and listen to that, if you missed it, go check that out. We'll talk a little bit more about him here. And we already talked about Marwan Maloof in the episode when it was reported that he had basically shaken hands with the Vikings and he was just kind of waiting for the Dolphins to hire their head coach, Brian Flores, to kind of let things all shake out in Miami. I believe the same thing was happening with Rick Dennison. It kind of took a while for Adam Gase to kind of solidify his whole staff because there were elements that he was waiting on from the two Super Bowl teams. And that was, I think, the domino we were waiting for with Rick Dennison because he was still with the Jets. The Jets then hire somebody else to be their offensive line coach, leaving Rick Dennison to come rejoin his old buddy Gary Kubiak and that whole clan here in Minnesota. And then there's also Drew Petzing, who we haven't talked about at all. So we'll go over a little bit of his background and what we can maybe expect from him. He's a relatively young and relatively new coach. This is his first full-time position coaching job. He was been an assistant or an assistant position coach for his whole career, which has been pretty short. And we also had some speculation from, I believe it was Paul Allen on KFan, talking about how the Vikings are looking at some of their offensive line depth and thinking about actually blowing some of that up. And instead of, you know, just filling the holes that they already have or trying to improve upon positions, clearing out the entire room and bringing in a brand new influx of offensive linemen, which would be an interesting thing. We're going to talk about that, but we actually might have to put that off until a later episode this week because I actually want to go like fully into that idea and like what an offseason like that would look like and the costs and everything like that. So for now, we're just going to focus on the new coaches, which is the big news of the weekend for the Vikings. And then obviously in NFL news, or I guess general football news, over the weekend, the AAF had its first weekend. It was really fun. I had a great time watching all of it. I think a lot of the new rules are really interesting. I found myself not missing kickoffs at all. And I would love to hear your thoughts on the new league and what it could mean. And I think it could actually mean something really interesting for the Vikings, where we look at these guys and maybe there is an offensive lineman or two we can pull from these teams and possibly get them on a cheap deal. Most of the time when you take somebody who is playing in another league, like the Canadian League or back in the day of like the European League or like Arena, they come in as, you know, camp bodies, basically being paid camp body salaries. But if you could actually find a gem in the AAF or in the XFL in future years, you could really actually find like some talent at offensive line at a nice cheap price and actually be able to build your future. Because when you have an offensive line problem like the one that the Vikings have, throwing money at it can maybe make the players better, but then you have an overpaid offensive line and that's a whole other problem that you have to fix. So really, that's why it's, you know, obviously best to fix things through the draft if you're able to do so, because you get, you know, young players that you don't have to pay a lot right away, that you get to kind of develop and have them become, you know, your like long-term stars, whereas free agents tend to be a little bit more temporary, right? Guys kind of like Sheldon Richardson that come grace your team for a year and then move on, you have to replace them again. And that's because they're like usually very expensive, right? In 2018, the Vikings were willing to pay Sheldon Richardson. That might not be true in 2019, but it might be true for another team. And so those guys will bounce around the league. But for somebody who doesn't come with a huge contract because they're coming out from, you know, like a quote-unquote developmental league like the AAF, you can keep that player on your roster more easily, and then that sets you up better to, like, lock that person down long-term, assuming that they are, like, actually as good as they would look in the AAF. But they're also very cheap, so, you know, bringing somebody over at very low risk because, you know, they just won't carry a huge price tag, they won't cost a draft pick, etc. It's definitely something to keep an eye on. So if you are only a fan of the Vikings and you don't care about the league, it might just be worth it to like scout the guys you think maybe are good for the roster. The other thing about the AAF that I really want to just kind of share with you guys is that they give you a lot more access to the sideline, which I think is really fun, right? Like, you can hear, you know, you could hear Mike Mertz talking to his quarterback on the sideline. You could hear the play calls in the huddle. And a lot of that is gibberish, you know? It's like hash right, HY back. Like, it's a bunch of stuff that doesn't mean anything unless you're very familiar with those play calls. Like, I was watching the San Diego Fleet game, which was coached by Mike Mertz, and Trent Green was in the booth. Trent Green was a quarterback for Mike Mertz and was able to kind of translate those play calls, which I found really fun. But it's still really interesting to listen how they talk about things. There was a moment on the San Antonio Commanders sideline where it was a 3rd-and-13, and the Commanders coach said, all right, I'm thinking mesh, which is a play call that involves a lot of like crossing routes. It's kind of a shallow yards after the catch type play call that really is, it's kind of a give up play call on 3rd-and-13 where, all right, we'll just get some room for the punter to work. And if the guy breaks it open and we convert, great, but we're not trying to. And the quarterback, Logan Woodside, said, no, run all goes, meaning like the classic, like four verticals. I think it was actually three verticals, but you know, run everybody deep and I can hit the throw. And he said, okay, we're going to try it. And it turns out he couldn't hit the throw. If you had seen that without that sideline conversation, you know, contextualizing it, you would have just seen them call a bunch of deep routes and the quarterback couldn't call it, you know, couldn't throw it. And that would have been that. And you would have said, oh, he missed the throw, or, oh, that was a bad play call. They should have, you know, made it an easier throw for their quarterback or something. But hearing that sideline conversation can really contextualize decisions. And I think it's a really interesting lesson that we can learn about play calling, that like these kinds of conversations happen. And sometimes the call that actually happens on the field isn't the one that was in the offensive coordinator's head in the first place. And maybe, you know, like for better or worse. So it's really interesting to think about all that stuff and think about the kind of conversations that go on and how play calling evolves from the minds of many people, from the quarterback to the head coach to the OC to, you know, somebody who just saw something on from the sideline. It's really interesting. That access is really cool. And I think it's worth watching just to kind of learn about, like, how football players and football coaches talk to each other. The whole thing, it's really neat, and maybe it can help us scratch our football itch here in the month of February. So I'm going to step away to a quick ad break, and when we come back, it's going to be all Rick Dennison all the time. All right, we are back. So let's talk about Rick Dennison. But before we go into him and his history and stuff, let's talk a little bit about the position that he's taking over, because he's not just the offensive line coach. He's the offensive line coach slash run game coordinator. Now, I don't remember if Tony Sparano filled that role in name, but he certainly filled it in principle. That is to say, it was his run game. The Vikings ran, you know, his scheme with his ideas. They ran his wildcat and everything. And he was the one really like drawing up those plays. So losing him in 2018, it shouldn't be that surprising that, you know, Andrew Janoco and Clancy Barone couldn't take over that kind of schematic role. So enter Rick Dennison, who only had that title in one season, and that was last season with the Jets, but he's been with this Gary Kubiak kind of clan for pretty much his whole career. And it starts in Denver when they all worked for Mike Shanahan in the, you know, the old like Jake Plummer years and the even back to like the Elway times. And by 2006, which is the first year where we have a lot of the data that I pulled from PFF for this whole segment, he's the offensive coordinator in Denver. He has that job for 3 years. He goes back to being the O-line coach in 2009, and then everybody gets cleaned out, and basically the whole crew moves on to Houston, where Gary Kubiak gets hired as a head coach. He stays as the offensive coordinator for Gary Kubiak there all the way through 2013, where they had that like totally awful 2-14 year that gave them the first overall pick. Everybody gets cleaned out again. They all meet in Baltimore for a hot second and then end up back in Denver for the next couple years. Gary Kubiak wins a Super Bowl, then he retires, they all go their separate ways, and then Rick Dennison, you know, bounces through the Jets and the Bills before he ends up here. All of this is to say, in most of the roles that he had with Gary Kubiak, it was strategic, right? He was the offensive coordinator, not an offensive line coach. So he really is a more strategic addition, and it's why I don't think he's coming in, I don't think they hired him to help develop young talent. Or to work on fundamentals, or to be like a teacher, like what I kind of think George Edwards is for the Zimmer defense, or, you know, somebody like Andre Patterson is. I think he's much more of a strategic element. Be a brain in the room that can design a good run play. And that's what he did for Kubiak for most of the time he was with Kubiak. So it makes sense that they would bring him to do the same thing now that Kubiak is in Minnesota. So that kind of lays out two different things in terms of context here. For one, when we're like judging Rick Dennison as a hire, we should look at the run games that he's coordinated and the success and the scheme, and not necessarily the individual offensive linemen that he's coached. He's only actually had 2 years of offensive line coaching, one in Denver and one recently with the Jets. But even that, he was still the run game coordinator as well, so it was still like a strategic role. His job here is going to be strategy, not development. So we should judge him on strategy. And the other thing is, they hired an offensive line coach who is not here for development, which means that when it comes to, you know, fundamentals and technique and just kind of like the minuscule things that you drill every day, that's still going to be run, as far as I know, by Clancy Barone and Andrew Janoco. And that is potentially concerning, because those were the guys doing that in 2018 and it wasn't good enough. And those have been the kind of assistants doing it under Sperano, and it hasn't been good enough. And I don't think Rick Dennison really moves the needle either way on the actual development of players and like making them better offensive linemen than they were before. That doesn't seem like something that the Vikings are equipped to do. And so when it comes to, you know, our expectations for guys like O'Neal and Elflein and like these young players like developing and whoever they draft, I think that our expectations might have to be lower, because they've focused a lot more on fixing the scheme than fixing the players. And they might not be wrong about that. Like, there could totally be merit to, okay, you know, we think we have the players, we think they can do it well enough, and we just weren't putting them in a position to succeed, and that's why we fired the OC and we brought in Kubiak and all this zone run stuff, and we're gonna, you know, fix the plan, make it easier for these guys. And that is like a reasonable way to make bad players better, right? If they aren't very good at their job, make their job easier. But on the other hand, maybe we want them to attack it from all the angles, right? Make the players better and make their jobs easier. Obviously, the offseason is far from over. We don't know what they're going to do in free agency. We don't know what they're going to do in the draft. And at the end of that, then we can kind of look and say, okay, what was their plan for offensive line? What kinds of things have they done? And what should our expectations be? But with Rick Dennison, I don't think his experience as an offensive coordinator helps him develop offensive line talent. I think it helps make their jobs easier. And maybe that's good enough, and maybe it isn't. It all remains to be seen. But since all of these coaching hires have basically been a declaration that, hey, you know, the run game problems weren't necessarily the fault of talent, they were the fault of scheme, and here we are, we're fixing the scheme. So let's actually look at Rick Dennison from a scheme perspective, and by extension, Gary Kubiak. But basically, we're like adopting, you know, the coaching that led to all these run games. And we can, you know, we have a lot of data. We can look at these run games and say, okay, were the schemes good? Were they successful? Were they productive? And there's a bunch of different measures we can look at to kind of contextualize all that, right? So we can look at DVOA. I've talked about that stat a lot on this podcast, but it's basically, if you take a game situation, all right, it's, you know, 3rd and 3, how do teams usually do on 3rd and 3? Okay, well, average, they get 2 yards. I don't know. And did you do better or worse than what an average team does in that situation? That's a super oversimplified way of describing DVOA, but it's basically your production kind of in the context of your down and your distance and your place on the field, and it's opponent adjusted. So which defenses did you go up against? It's a very nice measure for like overall production. How did you do? Or better yet, like, were the yards that you gained enough often enough? We also have PFF grades, but PFF grades can be a little difficult because they're very often evaluating the player, not the team. So you could have, for example, 5 offensive linemen block very well, and then you get a very high run blocking grade. And then the running back, you know, drops the ball on the exchange and he gets a really bad grade and it's a fumble. So you could have like a whole team get a really good grade on a turnover. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So that's why we pull DVOA, because then we can cross-reference with the production and make sure that there isn't anything weird or out of place going on. And I actually spoke with Eric Eager from PFF. We talked to him a couple weeks ago about the QB annual. And I just asked him, hey, you know, run blocking grades for a team, is that a reflection of scheme, right? Because you can kind of think about like a running play, and there are 5 offensive linemen, 1 running back, and all 5 offensive linemen have to make their blocks before the running back even really gets a reasonable chance to make it a play. So looking at the run blocking grades, like, hey, is that like, if I were to evaluate a guy like Rick Dennison based on the run blocking grades of the offensive linemen in the offense that he was coordinating, like, is that a reflection of his running scheme? And Eric basically said, yes, offensive linemen own the running production, and their grades are very often affected by scheme, and if they were, you know, asked to do things that they're good at doing, like, we can't separate that out, right? So essentially looking at a run blocking grade can be a very, like, informative way of evaluating the coach of that position group or just the coach of the run game. And we also have information about, like, the running backs he was working with. You know, he had Arian Foster for a while, although that guy was an undrafted free agent, so some of that development and success could be credited to the coaches that ended up getting him. But there were other times where he was working with, like, Michael Pittman and a bunch of kind of random people that never really made a name for themselves outside of those offenses. So I think that's also important context to go over. So we're going to go over, like, season by season everything, and we're going to talk about Drew Petzing. But first, I do want to step away for the second ad break so that when we can come back, we can just focus on this and get it done. So I will see you all in a minute. All right, we are back. So let's look at these Rick Dennison running games. And we're going to start in 2006, which is where this data starts, although he was coordinating before that. This is where the data starts. And honestly, like, that's 12 years of data. Like, that should be plenty. So he was the OC by that point. He's working with Tatum Bell. And the run blocking grades, which I think is going to be the kind of main focus of what we're doing, and we're just going to look at the DVOA to make sure that, like, we aren't being fooled here, starts at a 72.9. So for context, a 60 is average. So this is above average, but run blocking grades tend to be very inflated because, in a word, offensive linemen are just better at run blocking. They're usually tailored to run blocking. If you think about, like, in a high school, you know, your biggest, beefiest people, you're going to put them on the offensive line, and they're going to be a lot better at pushing than they are at, you know, the kind of finesse and technique, and like, pass blocking is just, like, more difficult. And it's a trend over all of these years that run blocking grades are a little inflated. So we can kind of up the standard and call a 72.9, like, very average and very much okay. And fittingly, he ranked 19th in rushing DVOA. The running grade coming from Tatum Bell was a 48.1, which is very bad. So he's working with a bad running back. He got okay blocking, and that turned into, like, meh DVOA for his first year. Moving on to, like, 2007, it was kind of a similar story with Travis Henry was the primary back. There's a name for a throwback. A little bit better rushing grade, a little bit better run blocking grade, and they improved to 13th in DVOA. So things were, you know, that as his career went on, things got a little easier. And then we get to 2008, which was a historic year for rushing. There were, I think, like, 14 teams that had run blocking grades in the 90s, and Rick Dennison's was one of them, actually ranking third in that statistic with a 94.7. So that means that PFF is essentially saying, all right, the run blocking at that for that team for that year was elite. They were working with Michael Pittman as the primary running back, and then they actually achieve the number one rush DVOA for that season. So they were in a season of historic rushing, you know, in the season where the Wildcat had happened and all of that, this, like, crazy 2008 year. The Denver Broncos running game was the most productive one in the league, and I think Rick Dennison and, to a degree, Gary Kubiak deserve a lot of credit for that. And then in 09, things kind of fall back to earth. The run blocking grade goes back down to an 85, still very well above average, but not nearly like the elite unit that they were the year before, and the rush DVOA falls to 20th. So there was a little bit of a regression, and then everybody gets cleaned out as Mike Shanahan gets fired and all that, and they all go over to Houston, where they have this guy named Arian Foster on the team. And for the first 2 years of that, they have top 10 rush DVOA. They've got run blocking grades in the 90s. It was a really, really excellent time to be Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison in terms of the run game. And I think this is the time when they really proved, all right, these guys are masters of the zone run. This is the time where they really made that reputation in the league. So things kind of regress back again in 2012. And then in 2013, the run blocking actually gets better. It was an 85.4 in 2012. In 2013, it goes up to an 88. But if you remember, Arian Foster got hurt that year, and most of the snaps were carried by a guy named Ben Tate, who actually graced the Vikings a couple years later. But the DVOA wasn't nearly as good. It was 24th, and the team went 2-14, and everybody got fired. So we won't count the year in Baltimore because he was actually the QB's coach there, which I think was just an excuse to get him in the room because the whole crew kind of always stays together. And then they go back to Denver where Ronnie Hillman becomes the primary back in 2015 and they win the Super Bowl. But here's where we start to see a little bit of a troubling pattern of regression. The run blocking grade goes down to a 79. That's the worst one he had since 2006, the first year we started tracking this. And the run DVOA is 20th. In 2016, it's not any better, 78 run blocking grade. The rush DVOA falls to 29th in the league, and then Gary Kubiak retires. He goes to Buffalo, where he has LeSean McCoy and a bunch of weird offensive linemen. They have the 19th best run DVOA and a run blocking grade of 69.2. And then I think his actually worst season comes in New York, where he's working with Isaiah Crowell and that whole offensive line. He has a run blocking grade of 68.2. That is the worst run blocking grade that we've been tracking here since PFF has been tracking, and the 30th rush DVOA. So there's a really strong argument that he's coming off of his worst season and we're hiring him to do the thing he just did, the worst he's ever done. All that said, there's a lot more than last year, right? And we can probably, looking at his whole career, expect a little bit of upward regression, right? Regression is something that cuts both ways. So looking at all of this and all the data, you know, that we have, like decades of this, it looks like Rick Dennison's pretty good at coordinating run games. And I think he and Kubiak know how to draw up a zone run game that works. Now, the success has not been very common recently, and that's really troublesome because the league changes, and they haven't had like a really good run game since like 2013, 2012. It's been a long time since then, and the league has changed and things are different. But if they are able to do what they do, and if what they do still works, they will be successful at it. Like, they will execute what they do, and it's just a matter of if that's a good idea. And we'll actually have a lot more information coming out about zone running in general. I know that Pro Football Focus is doing some work on different run schemes and kind of tracking which run plays are called when and which are better to call and which have been more successful and all that. So we're going to table this for now, and we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about Drew Petzing, who we haven't touched on at all yet. So he's going to be the wide receivers coach. He was an assistant in the Vikings organization for all of Mike Zimmer's tenure, but his first NFL job was as a coaching intern in 2013 for the Cleveland Browns. And who else was in Cleveland in 2013? One, Norv Turner, right? So he must have made an impression on Norv Turner. Norv gets hired to be the offensive coordinator for the Vikings when Mike Zimmer comes. He brings Drew Petzing along with him. And then when Turner resigns, or is, I guess, like secretly fired or whatever you think happened there, Drew Petzing does not leave with him. And I think that says something about the organization's opinion on the guy. When, you know, you are bringing in Pat Shurmur and then Shurmur leaves and then you're bringing in DeFilippo and he leaves, kind of the same thing with Kevin Stefanski, right? There's a whole bunch of turnover and you keep not getting fired with all the other people. So through all that time, he's the assistant wide receivers coach for a while. He's the assistant quarterbacks coach last year. Now he's getting promoted to be the full-on wide receivers coach. And I think that a guy that's pretty young in terms of NFL standards, you know, he's only been coaching professionally in the league since 2013, so that's a fairly green person. But he was around when, you know, Adam Thielen was developing. He was around when Stephon Diggs was developing, and he was in those wide receivers rooms as a part of that whole thing. So if you are looking for continuity at wide receiver, which has been one of the positions where the Vikings have had a lot of success, you know, Laquon Treadwell aside, guys like Chad Beebe, you know, outperforming their expectations, a guy like Thielen improving every year, a guy like Diggs outperforming his expectations, like that reflects very well on the coaches that were in the room at the time, and Drew Petzing was one of those guys. So I think there's reason for optimism there. Obviously, he's a complete unknown in terms of like actual track record, because he's never been the guy like fully responsible for all this. But he was there for all of those offensive coordinators. He was there for, you know, George Stewart, who was fired, and he wasn't fired along with George Stewart. And he was there for Daryl Hazel. So if the Vikings' philosophy is, hey, Diggs and Thielen worked out really well, and developmentally we're happy with this, let's stick to as close as to that plan as we could, I think Drew Petzing is your answer. So one more word before I move on to just a quick housekeeping thing, and then we wrap up on Rick Dennison. This is something I only wanted to get to if there was time, and there is time, so I'm going to touch on it real quick. I'll link to all of these charts that I made in the show notes, but I made a chart of the run blocking grades from the last year Rick Dennison was somewhere, and then how they did the year after he left. And in each one of those scenarios, so right after he leaves the Broncos, right after he leaves the Texans, right after he leaves the Broncos a second time, and then right after he leaves the Bills, obviously I don't have one for the Jets because that would be their 2019 grades, but every single time he left a team, they were worse at run blocking the next year. And that, I think, reflects really well on the guy when, like, teams do worse after you're not there all the time. Like, that has to be telling. And when we have four different examples of this, like, that's starting to be an actually telling sample. So despite all the criticisms that I've levied over the course of this show, that is, like, a really nice cause for optimism. So that's going to do it for the coaches. But real quick, I did not bring up in the beginning of the show, like I usually did, we still have the pain bracket. It is round two, and we are going to start with an old heartbreak versus a new heartbreak. It's going to be Super Bowl IV versus the Chiefs, the first Super Bowl the Vikings were in, the first one they lost, the first win for the Chiefs, a horrible upset, versus Blair Walsh kicking it wide left. Make sure you go vote in that poll. It should be up by the time this releases so that you can go vote, go participate. We should have a whole bunch of fun, and we should have the semifinals locked by the end of the week. So that is going to do it for today's episode of Locked On Vikings. Thank you all for listening to me blather on about coaches that I've already talked about a whole bunch. You can follow the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. You can find me on Twitter at Luke Braun NFL. You can go to the show notes for all the charts that I've been referencing the whole time. And I will see you all tomorrow morning. Skol!